The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the transmission of the light, Upagupta. Upagupta attended Shanavasa for 3 years, then finally shaved his head and became a mendicant. Shanavasa asked him, "Are you leaving home physically or mentally?" Upagupta said, "Actually, I'm leaving home physically." Shanavasa said, "What has the sublime truth of the Buddhas to do with body or mind?" On hearing this, Upagupta was enlightened. Kezan's verse. The house broken up, the people gone, no inside or outside. Where have body and mind ever hidden their forms? Here's another story. In the morning, the bhikkhuni Vajira, dressed and taking her bowl and robe, entered Savasi for alms. When she had walked for alms and had returned from her alms round after her meal, she went to the blind man's grove for the day's abiding. Having plunged into the blind man's grove, she sat down at the foot of a tree for the day's abiding, her meditation. And then Mara, desiring to arouse fear and trepidation and terror in the bhikkhuni Vajira, desiring to make her fall away from her concentration, approached her and asked, "By whom has this being been created? Where is the maker of this being? Where has the being arisen? Where does the being cease?" And it occurred to Vajira, "This is Mara, who has recited this verse, desiring to arouse fear and trepidation and terror in me, desiring to make me fall away from my concentration." And so she said to Mara, "Why do you now assume a being? Mara, have you grasped a view? This is a heap of sheer constructions. Here, no being is found. Just as with an assemblage of parts, the word chariot is used, so when the aggregates are present, there's the convention, a being. It's only suffering that comes from this, suffering that stands and falls away. Nothing but dukkha comes to be, nothing but dukkha ceases." And then Mara, realizing the bhikkhuna Vajira knows me, sad and disappointed, disappeared. So sad. But not yet giving up. And these are related, these two stories, and related to what I wanted to talk about today, which is home leaving, which is the term that is used in Mahayana Buddhism, particularly for ordination. So, as you were part of this morning, Fusei and Rugetsu became postulants this morning. And this is a ceremony that usually, we've never done it on a Sunday. We usually do it in the middle of the week, following a morning service. Just the residents are here. It's very quiet. It's very simple. The rest of the Sangha may not even know. They just come one day and they see somebody wearing a black robe. And in a very real sense, that's fitting of that moment of transition. In a way, it's a simple step. The postulant dons a black robe, but it's not yet the monastic robe. They take no vows. There is just a simple recognition of stepping into this period of discernment, and both within themselves, and it's also then recognized within the Sangha that this is what's happening with this particular student. And so it's the formal beginning of monastic discernment, although, of course, those two students have been contemplating this for some time. And so it's the beginning, potentially the beginning of home leaving home, which has, in the Buddhist tradition, been to leave one's family, to take on a Buddhist name, to shave one's head, to enter into the family of the Sangha. And traditionally, that would have been the ordained Sangha, the people that you're making your lives with and share in your lives with each day. Giving up possessions, and so our vows of simplicity, which is to have no personal wealth, to stability of mind and body, and in life choices, life situations, selflessness to practice and realize, selflessness and to actualize that through service and to accomplish the Buddha's way, to live as much as we can in our time and in our particular tradition and form of monastic training in the example of the Buddha. And as Shanavasa makes clear, that there is a physical aspect, there is a mental aspect, you could say, but ultimately and at its core, there's something much, much more important going on, much deeper. Dato Roshi, the norm in much of Western Buddhism is that with ordination, the ordained becomes what is usually referred to as a priest. And so they are ordained, and typically most priests in most sanghas that I'm aware of will live at home, have their own homes, most of them have livelihoods, they have families. So they live in many ways like a layperson, but they're ordained and they've taken those ordination vows, whatever they might be. In our tradition, it's really the bodhisattva vows that we receive at receiving the precepts. But their vow is to live the life of a priest. Dato Roshi wanted to make a distinction, a more clear distinction, between the lay and the monastic path. So the lay path was the path of the householder, the home dweller, he used to describe the householder path as, and the monastic. And so he wanted to establish a monastery where the monastics would take life vows. And so he created these particular vows, simplicity, service, stability, and so on, that really defined the life so that it was distinct and different. So it was not having ownership, it was not having children, or if there are children that, when I first came, Kyodo was the head monk. She was a novice, she wasn't fully ordained, even though she'd been here a while, because she still had a son who was living with her up the hill in one of the cabins. And so he wouldn't ordain her until her son was independent, so that she was no longer really responsible as his primary, source of support. And so he wanted those two paths to be distinct, and in that way, to each have their own integrity, to be clear and complete and viable paths by making them, clear and distinct, not blurred. There are actually very few in the Zen tradition in the West, at least in the U.S., very few of these, right? And there are places where people do ordain, but they may or may not consider those monasteries. They often live as priests, as I've described. And so Dato Roshi wanted to really establish as both following the Buddhist model and borrowing and learning from, in many ways, the Western Christian model of monasticism. And what's really important with the discernment process is that it's just that. It's a period of discernment, that the student is entering in a very conscious way and is examining every day the life that they feel drawn to, the monastic life, and they're now experiencing it more from within that monastic cloister. So they are more seeing themselves, being seen as a monastic, being related to, they're joining in with the other monastics and the things that we do as a body within ourselves. They're also being given the responsibilities and taking on more of those physical aspects of the life that are part of the monastic, which is to take on responsibility, to be a sort of central part of what allows a monastery to function. And in that, they're seeing, how is that going? is that in alignment and continue to be in alignment? Does that affirm their basic sense of what they feel like they're being called to? How does that develop over time? And time is a really important part of this. It needs time, right? Because just like it's not marriage, but you wouldn't want to, you know, decide to get married to somebody and make life vows with somebody at a moment when you're so in love, right? And say, okay, that's it. Or in a moment when you're really not. And you decide, okay, I don't want this. That's not a good idea, right? You want to go through many such moments and all those in between and see what happens over time, in time, with time, as you're experiencing, as the monastic is experiencing, the ups and downs, the everyday highs and lows, the things that pull them in, draw them in, the things that don't, and living with all within all of the various aspects. I was just remembering many years ago when my brother, many years ago, became a Sikh, which he'd lived as for many, many years. And he came home for the first time. He'd been away for a number of years, living in Alaska, and came home and showed up as a Sikh. And my family was like, what? And we didn't really know that that had happened. He hadn't really sort of brought us along. I mean, we knew he was somewhat involved, but, and so during that visit where, you know, my family was, particularly my parents were sort of taking this in, I was alone with him and I said, why did you do it this way? I said, why did you just suddenly, you know, why didn't you sort of share this along the way? He said, because I didn't feel confident. I knew that I still had doubts and insecurities, and I knew that if I shared this with my parents, my family, that they would increase those doubts. And he said, I didn't feel stable enough to deal with that. So when I was in discernment, I didn't do what he did, because I saw the impact that it had on them. And I let them know what was going on for me, but there was a lag. There was a lag between what was actually happening and what I told them, right? So at the point when I was pretty clear what I wanted to do, I said, you know, I'm thinking about this. I don't know whether I was doing that for them or me, but. And, oh, but the reason that came to mind was my mother was asking him questions about his life. And at a certain point, he said, you can't really know, right? Because you're not doing it. Somebody who's doing it. And again, afterwards, I said, dude, that was really kind of harsh, you know? And he said, but it's true. I said, I know it's true. But to say that, it just feels very like, no, you can't come into this. You know, I won't let you in. Sorry, bro, if you're listening to this, you know, I love you. We already had this conversation, right? But of course it is true. I mean, even in the simplest of ways, we cannot be an intimate part. We can't know another person's experience, even in the simplest of ways, much less to say, you know, such a significant life direction. And what's really important to appreciate about the discernment process for everybody, which is one of the reasons I wanted to do this today, and Hojin Sensei is going to do full ordination for Sekku at the end of the next session in July. And that's a very full ordination. There's a lot that happens in that, and so that needs to happen. And so she will, I'm sure, talk about ordination in the path, but it's hard to say as much as I am because there's just not time for that. So I wanted to kind of take this opportunity to say a little bit more. So one of the things that's important for all of us to appreciate about the discernment is that its whole purpose is to bring clarity in the student's mind about the life, the path choice that they're taking. It's not in question about their relationship with the Dharma. In fact, sometimes people think, you know, because I'm really devoted to the Dharma, and we have many, many students, practitioners in our Sangha, many of you in this room right now who are extremely devoted to the Dharma. You've really centered this in your life. It's a vital part of your life, and that's been true for years. It's not about that. And sometimes people think if they feel that way, that must mean that they should be a monastic. And it doesn't necessarily mean that. That's sort of the vital thing, is that intimate, direct experience of the Dharma, relationship with the Dharma, because that belongs to you, and you take that with you wherever you go. That's why we take refuge in the Dharma. That's why, in a sense, taking refuge in the Dharma is the most important of the refuges, I think. Because the Buddha and Dharma arise out of that. But if that's not strong, then there can be trouble. And so it's to really clarify which of those paths of how that person wants to live their devotion to the Dharma, how they want to live a Dharma life. And it's important to know, because all the way up to full ordination, up to the morning of, that person in discernment can change their mind and say, you know what? I know, like, everything's ready and the bell is sounding, but, you know, I think actually I need to go in another direction. It's like, okay, this has been a successful discernment. Successful because you have clarified what it is that your life's path is. It is not, successful doesn't mean being fully ordained, unless that is the choice that the person wants to make. And it's really important to know that for everybody, so that we understand together that if any monastic up to the point of discernment decides to step away, that that's not a problem. It doesn't mean something's wrong. It means they have clarified something that they were very consciously in the process of clarifying. So both doors are open. And that in that discernment, it's not just the desires and aspirations in terms of the role or the place that the Dharma has in one's life. It is mental. It is physical. It is everything. It draws everything from a person. And in that, the student, the person in discernment, is seeing what is being asked of them. What do they need to actually be cultivating, bringing forth to live this life, which is, in many ways, a demanding life, right? It's a disciplined life. And so, as they're being called to bring those forth, what is that experience that they're having? And is that continued, does that continue, those experiences continue to affirm their basic sense that this is the life that they want? Or does it bring up doubts and insecurities? If there is a time for that, this is the time. This is the time to really be examining anything that might be calling or pulling or not sure, doubts, insecurities, like, where is the mind going? I've told this story about, we had a, I think she was a novice years ago, and I would see her in the dining room pouring through mail order catalogs, right? Like all the things that she wanted to buy but couldn't, right? Because as we stay in this process longer and longer, our resources are starting to dry up, right? When I came, it was easy. I came with none, so. But she had a few, and I just watched her, you know, and there's, okay, how's this vow of simplicity going to go here? Like, she's working that out. She's working that out. And before she was fully ordained, a family member passed away, and unexpectedly she got an inheritance. And she decided to leave. And I thought, perfect. I mean, perfect that that could have happened. I said to Dottie, we should like make that happen for every, you know, some windfall, you know. So is the person able to live, not just able to live, but are they living within the challenges of ongoing training, self-examination, and community life? Oh yeah, there's that, living with others. And everybody's implicated in that, right? It's not just monks, not just residents, it's everybody that comes through the door, because they are into sermon about a life of service, giving. And yet every monastic, by their nature of their calling, is drawn to solitude. Very envious of you during this week, right? And so that's a basic dynamic that we are very aware of. We discuss it, right? That very important dynamic. If there is no draw towards solitude, that should really be examined, right? To solitude, to quiet, to stillness. That's always been the heartbeat of a monastic community and life. So how is all of that sort of settling within the person? And are they able to be joyful, to thrive? In other words, is it fulfilling? No, not just can you do it, can you stick it out, right? That's not going to work. Not for long, right? But does it actually bring joy? Does a person feel like this is helping them to actually thrive as a human being in their life? I remember a monastic meeting we were having a few years ago. I don't remember what we were talking about. We meet every week and study and discuss things. And somebody talked about being called to this and feeling like they didn't have a choice. And I felt like I knew what they were talking about and that I could identify with that. But I said, no, you have to have a choice. In other words, if the monastic feels like they can't be anywhere else, that's not good. Like if you feel like you're kind of trapped here because you can't live a life somewhere else, then you're not really making a choice. It's not a clear choice. It's more of an escape. There's something that's not taken care of, right? So in a sense, we have to know that, yes, I could live a life somewhere else. Any of the monastics could live a life somewhere else, but they are choosing to live this life. That's a different kind of thing. That's a choice freely given. In the commentary, Kazan says, those who leave home physically give up social and personal sentiments. They leave their native place, shave off their hair, and dress in black. They have no servants. Becoming mendicants. They work on the way 24 hours a day. They waste no time and have no extraneous desires. Therefore, they are not happy to be alive, and they are not fearful to die. Their minds are like the pure clarity of the autumn moon. Their eyes are like the flawlessness of a bright mirror. They do not seek mind or look for essence. They do not even practice the holy truths, much less have any worldly attachments. In this way, they don't remain in the state of ordinary mortals, but nor are they confined to the state of sages and saints. They are mind-free wayfarers. They are people who have left home physically. So here he is sort of defining to leave home physically in this particular way, the life of a monastic. Those who leave home mentally do not shave off their hair, or residents coming in to not shave their heads, right? Because often people do that out of enthusiasm or something, but it's to try and, you know, make a distinction. You know, it's not a hairstyle, right? Those who leave home mentally do not shave off their hair or wear special clothing. Though they live at home and are in the midst of the troubles of the world, they're like lotuses unsoiled by mud, like jewels unaffected by dust. Even though they may have spouses and children, according to circumstances, they are not attached to them. Said like a true celibate monastic. Like the moon in the sky, like a pearl rolling in a bowl, they see the one who is free in the midst of a bustling city. They understand beyond time while in the world. They know that even cutting off passions is a disease, and realize that it is cutting off all of the strong sort of emotional forces that we have within us, and realize that aiming for true thusness is also wrong. To them, nirvana and samsara are both illusory. They are concerned with neither enlightenment nor affliction. They are people who leave home mentally. And it's really a wonderful way, and Dada Roshi used this koan in the Eight Gates to talk about home leaving. So it's kind of a nice way of doing exactly what Dada Roshi was trying to do, which was really see the complete integrity, the wholeness and completeness of each path, and that each have their own deep spiritual nature, that are each about realizing the fundamental Buddha mind, living a life of non-attachment, actualizing Prajnaparamita within our respective places and with our respective roles and responsibilities and all that those demand of us. And that's where we make our life. That's where we find our path. And so the monastic life, we could say, is a sort of radical interiorizing, a sort of contemplatizing of one's life, mentally, spiritually, and physically, drawing all of our life's energies and interests, in a sense, inward, unifying with the path, seeing and practicing the Dharma. And so our work, our relationships, our studies, physical surroundings, our meals, our possessions, everything is basically in service to that. And so the monastics really don't own anything, right? I mean, we have whatever we came with, which is usually very simple. It has to be. We don't have storage sheds, right? We actually do, but not for the monastics. So we have to travel light, and our vow is to keep it light, right? And so everything within the environment is intentionally to be both visually, audibly, in every sensory way, sort of be clearly and viscerally, tangibly, sensorially connected to the Dharma. Examination of the self, of everything that arises that hinders us, of a selflessness and service, of ongoing practice of mindfulness and zazen and liturgy and our prostrations and our study every day, all the time, bringing it forth, swimming in that ocean. Hours of meditation, monthly sessions, angos, giving up control. The basic choice that the monastic makes is to live the monastic life. That's the basic choice we make. And then in that, we choose to give up making a lot of the other kinds of choices that are normal and natural to make in the world. Who we wake up with, who we sit with, what we're going to have for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, what my work is going to be, what time off means, time off the schedule. There were many times where Jim and I would be in our cabin prepared to just settle in for the night, and Dada Roshi would call up and say, hey, come on over and have dinner. Sometimes we would actually have food on the table. And we say, okay. And we come down and serve, be of service, and accept that invitation. So that's part of, you know, one of the questions that sometimes we ask monastics in discernment is, what do you think you're saying yes to, actually? Because naturally, the monastic usually thinks, I'm saying yes to this, to the way I'm experiencing this right now. That's going to change. Right. When Dada Roshi asked me to go to New York City and be the abbot there, right, in 2004, I thought I was going to spend the rest of my life here, which I was pretty happy about. And he said, will you do that? He said, I'd like you to do that. This was before when he knew he was going to be moving towards his death, but he said, will you do that? And I said, well, I was already down there, but in 2009, after he'd been diagnosed, when he'd been diagnosed, before he passed away, he said, I want you to be the abbot there and basically make your life there. And I said, okay. And then we went on to other things. And then he came back to me and he says, will you do that? Are you willing to do that? Which was very important, right, to me, that he was actually, it's like, oh, I can choose this, right? And I said, yes, I will. And in that vow, even though I loved this mountain, I kind of thought I would and maybe hoped I would spend the rest of my life here, I thought, okay, now all of that energy I'm now going to put in to loving Brooklyn and loving being in New York, because that's, I want, if I'm going to be there, I want to love being there. So what do I need to do to love Brooklyn? Right? How does that work? And so it continues to be a choice. Whenever the monastic would talk about the vow of service and speak of it in terms of obedience, he would say, hang on, it's not being obedient, it's serving. It's very different. It's freely given, at least in terms of how one might understand obedience. The lay dweller, of course, and I'm speaking more than I should, because you know better, most of you, but your energies are drawn outwards. The Buddha said this, to work, to family, to all of the things that you want and must give your lives to, keep your house in order, to build a good life, have a good life, daily zazen, in liturgy and study, coming to train, practicing mindfulness, doing angos, many of the things that the monastics do. In a sense, most of the things the monastics do. Different place, different setting, different conditions. In a sense, different vows and some shared vows. And so the importance of those two paths. And so when Shanavasa says, what has the sublime truth of the Buddha to do with body or mind? And when Vajira says, why do you now assume a being? What are you talking about? This is an aggregate of constructions. The skandhas, here, no being is found. Just like all the parts of a chariot. And so, because there's no being found, we can talk about a being, a self, a person, a body, a mind. But let's know what we're saying. Because within and throughout, there is a fundamental reality. And this is the core of the lay path and the monastic path, is to realize that which is free of body and mind, so that we can wake up every day within this body and mind and be free. And mingle with other bodies and minds and be free. And serve. And so we carry this Dharma, our Buddha nature, always complete, into our lives. And then everything that impinges or seems to obstruct or hinder or creates doubt or insecurity or aggrandizes becomes that very point of study, that very thing. As I said earlier in the week, which means we have to become more and more attuned and adept at recognizing all of the forms of dukkha, all of the ways in which we actually are in distress, not at ease, not at peace, not contented, not serene, but ways that are, as we continue, more and more subtle, discreet, sometimes hard to notice, and yet having impact. Affecting us, binding. As Keizan Zenji said, free from sacred and profane while living within sacred and profane. You know, one of the things that we discuss within the monastics, particularly with the teachers, is the vow, our vow to alleviate all suffering, to be of service in the world, and at the same time to sort of hold this charge, if you will, of maintaining this cloister, this place of practice, which is not just a meditation hall, right? It's a place of training. It's different. You know, sometimes, particularly when I was in the city, sometimes when people would come in, and they would want to just do whatever meditation was for them. And I would say, no, this isn't just a meditation hall. It's actually a place of training, right? It's not just a sort of a room where people come in and do meditation. It's a place where people train. And we train in Buddha Dharma. We train in a particular lineage. There's a particular path of training that we're doing. And the monastics, we live one path, in a sense, one life, but we each live that as individuals. And that too is important to appreciate, right? We're not cookie cutouts, right? We're individual people, and we are human beings. I mean, I'm stating the obvious, but sometimes it gets lost a little. And so each of us is in our own part of the path. And so within our aspirations, we aspire, and that we should demand of ourselves, and it's reasonable for the Sangha to expect that of us. And at the same time, we are human beings, so we will fail and fall and stumble and misstep and misspeak, just as you may, right? And we do that within our vows, just as you do. And we attend to that, just as you do. And the monastics relate to this training as individuals. And so even though we're all, in a sense, doing the same thing, we're doing it differently. And so how any one monastic relates to their meditation, to their liturgy, to their study, to their art practice and body practice, to their vows, is internal. It's individual. That's part of what each of us is developing, living, cultivating. And in discernment, we're discerning that. And so that's very important to appreciate, that each monastic has their own relationship with each of these aspects. You know, it's why somebody who goes through very vigorous, intensive training for many, many years like this may be empowered as a teacher and may leave and may not continue to teach or incorporate certain aspects of the practice. They did them while they were training, and they may have been an important part of their training, but they may not have really spoken to their sort of deepest inclinations. But we together stand on the same ground in a sense of wanting to realize the real. Dogen said in Genjo Koan, when first one seeks the Dharma, one is far away from it. When one has already correctly transmitted the Dharma to oneself, then one's original self at that moment is revealed. At the beginning of the monastic path in discernment, it can be difficult. It's probably going to be difficult. It probably already has been. And in discernment, those difficulties, in a sense, become more poignant, because now there are difficulties within that conscious sense of, okay, is this my life? I've told the story of how one day when I was a registrar, which used to be Sekou's desk now, and I was sitting there with my head in my hand. It was not a good day. I was not having a good day. I think it seemed pretty apparent, because Dada Roshi came up to me and said, "Oh, you want to make this your life, do you?" And I hated him a little bit for that, and I loved him a little bit for that, because I thought, yes, that is the question, isn't it? This day too. I have to choose this day too. And see, is in that, those difficulties, are those messages, are those communicating to the student in discernment, this isn't really your life. It's not working. You know, a person can feel very drawn to this, but in certain ways, it just doesn't suit them. That's not a fault, right? There is something we speak of as an affinity. Sometimes those gaps, to call them, that may be cultivated. Sometimes that's just, it's not the person's constitution, or it's just not their sort of inclination. Sometimes a person has a lot of those inclinations, but their motivation, their drive just isn't really, doesn't call to them to do this, or that's what they see. Sometimes they come in and think, this is life, those things that I'm going to renounce, those are not things that I really want. And then in discernment, as their life begins to change, they realize, oh, I think I do want those things. There are a lot of things that can happen, a lot of ways that it can unfold. But sometimes it's hard to know, are those signs that I'm receiving, that the person is receiving, are they signs of just turning inward? Like, this is your path of liberating yourself within your monastic life, or are they signs that they should listen to that maybe are indicating that they need to make a different choice? And no one can tell them that. They have to work that out. And that's why time is important. And so, I feel so grateful to Dada Roshi for establishing this and sort of having both that inner drive and love for the Dharma and for the possibility of this and the vision of this and the clarity of this, to have developed this and then to have evolved it over the years. And it keeps evolving, right? And so I'm so grateful to him that, just on a very personal level, that I can have this life. I mean, like, are you kidding me? You know, sometimes I think, why doesn't everybody want to do this? And sometimes I think, why does anybody want to do this? So I bow to my teacher for that gift, and not just to me or to the monastics, but I think to all of us. You know, this is a very old tradition, and the world is secularizing. I was just reading an article that was saying that Korea, which was a staunchly Buddhist country for many, many hundreds of years, is now much in the majority secular. And it's interesting because I was just there, and I saw that. I hadn't read the article, but I saw that from comparison to 30 years before when I had been there before. I could feel that it was different in terms of just the presence and sort of the sense of Buddhism being present when I was there before that I didn't sense. And certainly that's happening in the West. And that can make it seem like this is sort of an anachronism, monastic life. Obviously, I disagree. I know that we could not do this without the monastics. It just simply wouldn't be possible. We could not do this with, as profoundly indebted we are to everyone who offers service and volunteers in a whole host of ways among the lay sangha, we could not actually do this throughout the year with an all-volunteer group, because people have lives. Each of you who will go home today or eventually has a life, and that's as it should be. And so I think it, and not just because it allows us to have this as a way of training, because it provides a way of being in the world for those who are called, for those who, as Dada Roshi said, feel that spiritual imperative. And then allows us on these two distinct paths to practice together and have such profound respect, I hope, for those respective paths, and to learn from each other, be inspired by each other, as I hope we all are, and to grow together. So I'll end with a verse from Dada Roshi from that, his talk on the koan that I offered today. The one great pearl is always present. Dragon children are always born of dragon parents. But how can it be spoken of? The rains have passed, and the summer river runs deep and fast. May our lives be well.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.